you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that won't send you a presidential text message. I'm back from vacation, and we've got a lot to discuss, including our first thoughts on Assassin's Creed Odyssey, a game that Kirk and I will both be playing for many hours to come. We also talk about the news of the week on a Harry Potter open world game, Google's Project Stream finally getting revealed, and PlayStation Experience skipping this year. Then it's time for a Spider-Man spoiler cast, where we give our final thoughts on the latest PS4 exclusive and get in-depth on the story. You know what they say, go get 'em, Tiger. Let's go. And we are back for another episode. I have returned. My name is Jason Schreier. I'm the news editor at Kotaku.com, back from my travels, and rejoined once again by the editor at large of Kotaku.com, Kirk Hamilton. Hello, Kirk.
Hello, Jason. It's so nice to see you, and it's so nice to have you back. I hope you had good travels.
I did. I wanted to Skype in from Spain, but I think my wife would have gotten mad if I tried to do some work and record the podcast from abroad. But Maddie did an excellent job filling in for me. So thank
yeah,
you,
Matt. I think she did. We had a really good time. We've heard a lot of very positive feedback from people about Maddie. So know if you're sending us emails saying Maddie should be on the show more, that you have been heard, and we totally agree. So we will aim to have Maddie back on in the near future, because yeah, it was very fun doing this.
You have been heard. You have been listened to.
Yeah. One quick note about last week's episode. So there was an ad for a certain unnamed e-cigarette company that we had nothing to do with, that we heard some complaints about, and reached out to the people who handle the ad sales for our podcast and had those ads removed, asked them to not do that anymore. Sorry about that. We don't really want to be advertising e-cigarettes. So, that happened. It wasn't something we had anything to do with, and hopefully it won't happen again.
In totally unrelated news, don't smoke e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes are bad. You should just definitely not get them. So there's a lot to get to today. We have lots and lots of things to discuss. First, we are going to talk about some of the games that we have been playing. And since I was away for 2 weeks, traveling, gallivanting in Spain and Portugal.
Gallivanting. I feel like if you're going to do something in Spain, you're going to gallivant. That seems, seems about right.
Gallivanting and splurging on food. Amanda and I ate at some ridiculous restaurants, absolutely ridiculous restaurants. Some really good food in Portugal, especially. Mm. A lot of fresh fish and whatnot. But we also had a lot of time, a lot of downtime to play Switch games, because whether it was us just like killing a couple hours before dinner in our hotel or taking flights, we took 3 different flights across the country. We had a lot of Switch time. And so I got Amanda hooked on a PC game that just came to Switch called Into the Breach. And real quick overview for people who haven't heard of Into the Breach, it's made by the people who made FTL. It is this kind of bite-sized strategy game that's like a kaiju version of chess, where you play as giant robots protecting a city from monsters. And it's really, really cool. The big gimmick is that on every turn of this grid-based strategy game, you see what the monsters are about to do. So it's all about anticipation rather than it's all about reaction rather than anticipation. You don't have to worry like, oh no, what are they going to do on this next turn? You know exactly what they're going to do. And so the onus is on you to make smart decisions. And it's really addictive. It's really fun. It's really challenging. And Amanda just couldn't stop playing it, which I enjoyed. So I was like playing other stuff. And then eventually I was like, man, Amanda's playing it so much, it makes me really want to play it too. So we were both sitting there playing Into the Breach a bunch. Really fantastic game. Really good on Switch, especially. Definitely worth even rebuying, even if you played it on PC, it's just worth having handheld. And I hope they add more stuff to it, because I'm getting kind of sick of the same four maps and or the same four islands and the same kind of units that I've been using a bunch of times before. But man, what a good game.
Yeah, I wonder if going by FTL, which got that sort of updated edition with all that new stuff, it wouldn't surprise me if Into the Breach did as well, which, yeah, I would dig. I really like playing it on Switch. I didn't play that much on PC and haven't actually played that much yet on Switch, but you were telling me about Amanda and it was sort of similar. I had the same thought of, I'm going to go play a little bit of this game, I think. And it's a really good game, and it does work on Switch. I hope it's not out on phones yet, right? Or iPad or anything?
No, it's just Switch and PC right now.
Yeah, it seems like it'd do well on mobile, so assuming at some point it'll come
out. But the thing is, it needs... I don't know if it would work so well with... I mean, maybe... I'm sure it could work with touch controls.
Yeah, I think it would, but yeah.
Okay, I take that back. Yeah, it would totally work with touch controls. It would be fine with touch controls. Yeah, I'm sure it will. Hopefully they're focusing more on new stuff than they are on ports. But it's a very small team. I think their team is only a couple of people. So I don't think they have the bandwidth for doing all these things.
Yeah, no, they seem to move at their own speed, which I've always respected. I talked to those guys at the Game Developers Conference at the GDC Awards quite a while ago. It was when they were winning stuff for FTL, so it was years ago. And I was still doing... We used to do this more often, as we would be backstage and talk to the winners. And a lot of times it's like a really short interview and you don't have much time to say anything. And it was sort of the same way with those guys. They're really young when I met them. I remember just thinking, oh my God, you're children and you made this amazing game. Good job. And they were just really nice. And I get this sense from them that they just are very... They operate on their own speed. I think FTL was super successful, so they have the luxury of just saying, well, we're going to make another good game whenever we make it. And they clearly did. So yeah, it just seems like they'll do Into the Breach stuff at their own pace too, which, you know, more power to them.
Their own pace, which is not faster than light.
No.
I also have been playing a bunch of other stuff, including a little bit of Destiny, which you have been kind of mainlining since I've been gone. I left the day the raid came out, and so I have not gotten a chance to play that, but you certainly have.
Yeah, I've played a lot of this and, of course, talked to Maddie about it some on the show, which was sort of fun to talk to someone who doesn't play Destiny. And now I get to talk to someone who does about things that you still haven't seen that I have. I've talked enough about it on the show that we don't have to go super in depth, but the things that I've been doing most recently are the most interesting things in the game, the things that are the hardest to get to in the game and kind of take the most of almost absurd dedication, at least to have gotten to at this point in time, instead of, you know, you could get to them in a month and it would require a little bit less hardcore play than I've been doing. But they've been really, really cool. So what I've played that's most notable over the last couple of weeks is I finally played the raid, got all the way up to the final boss, Riven of a Thousand Voices, and also played this new dungeon called the Shattered Throne, which is almost cooler than the raid. It's more interesting than the raid in some ways. So I'll maybe tell you a little bit about both. The raid is, to anyone who doesn't know, Destiny raid is always the big end game thing. It's the most demanding thing in the game. It's kind of has the highest level requirement, especially this time they raised all the level requirements. So everything takes way longer to get to, which I get and I think is probably good in a lot of ways for the health of the game, but it's left me very exhausted. I'm actually not even really playing this week, and I'm kind of...
It's good for long-term, but less good for journalists who want to see the new stuff.
Yeah, and I do take into account that that's where I'm coming from. That is my perspective is, okay, I really want to see this just to know what it is, to write about it. If I didn't have that in my life, I would be more relaxed and would be fine with feeling like there was this out-of-reach thing that I was working toward. As it stands, though, I worked really, really hard to get to the point where I could finally raid and saw it. So, it is really good. It's a really good raid. It's a lot like other Destiny raids. Like, I don't think that it's so dramatically different as to be all that noteworthy, even though I've seen a lot of people say this is the best raid in Destiny history. It's fantastic. I kind of agree with that, I think. I haven't, you know, I've only done it once. It is really complicated.
Although I will say there's always going to be a place in my heart, and I'm sure many others' hearts, for Vault of Glass, the first time we ever experienced anything like that.
Yes, and but now when you look back at the Vault of Glass and you compare it to something like Oryx, there you know, you can see how their raid design has evolved over the years, and, you know, certainly some things are better. And this one, it feels closest to the Oryx raid, to King's Fall, in terms of how that raid was just so mechanically complex compared to every other raid actually in that game. And I think they kind of stepped back from that with the one that was in Rise of Iron. Well, I'm forgetting the name of that raid. What was it called? It was like the...
Wrath of the Machine.
There you go. The Wrath of the Machine. Like, that had really creative encounters, and I kind of liked that about it, even though that raid was beaten, I think, in like 2 hours or something ridiculous. And then this one, of course, took 18 hours. By the way, I don't know if you followed all of this. One of the most remarkable things about this raid was that two teams beat it within the first 24 hours, and the third team, which was actually Datto, Stefan Janke, who's come on this show before to talk with us about Destiny, he has a really great clan called Math Class. They do raids too. It took them 24 hours and 2 minutes, and they were so close,
and
but
they didn't get it. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, there was some reward. I think there's like an emblem you get if you make it in 24 hours, and they didn't get it because they were two minutes over.
Yeah, do you remember, by the way, so I was watching Datto's stream for a couple hours, and then I went to the airport, and we flew to Barcelona, and I landed, and I hopped on the airport Wi-Fi when I landed, and I texted you. I was like, holy shit, I just landed in Barcelona, and nobody's beaten the raid still. They were like on the final boss, and it took them hours and hours to get through.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so now having done it, I totally get why. It is so complicated. I mean, so our friend Adam, who writes for Mashable and is very, very into Destiny, and is, you know, he's raided a whole ton of times. He plays with a crew of people who are really
hardcore. He just tweeted
hardcore.
That he got to 600.
Yeah. He's at 600, which I don't know if I'll ever even get there until the next expansion. But he played a lot more, and he was really great. He kind of Sherpa'd us and kind of just told us what to do on each encounter. There is almost nothing more surreal, though, than sitting down for one of those really complicated encounters and listening to someone tell you what's about to happen when you have no frame of reference. I can't even recreate it here. I couldn't even attempt to do it because it's so convoluted and ridiculous and complicated. But each encounter is increasingly more complicated. And I just can't imagine the process of figuring some of it out. There's one encounter called the Vault. I'm not going to spoil this for anybody who like hasn't done the raid and wants to see it. I'll be vague. But one of the encounters, the second to last encounter, is called the Vault, and you have to unlock this vault. And to do that, you have to kind of cleanse these rifts on the ground, which it's all kind of familiar stuff if you've done a raid before. But there is this stuff with like penumbral and antumbral charges, and you have to assign like left and right qualities to each of these three things. And we were using chat, the in-game chat, to leave a text record of what was happening that you could check at any moment. So you could pop open chat and see, oh, okay. And it was this code that was written out. It was so fucking complicated. And I was just laughing. And we actually beat it, you know, once we had someone explaining it to me. But it really doubles down on that unbelievable mechanical complexity. Okay, this thing, and then if this happens, then this happens, and there's this like clockwork aspect to it. And that's cool, but also a little overwhelming. And I don't know, it's a well-made raid. I like it, and it's visually amazing. Like, it is the coolest looking shit I've ever seen in a Destiny raid. The final boss is just bananas looking. I mean, just totally cool.
Kirk, we did the thing where we said we don't want to get in depth on Destiny, and then we talked too long about Destiny.
Oh yeah, well, okay, so I'll just say that the raid I thought was cool. I don't know when I'm gonna do it again. I'll beat it sometime. The Shattered Throne, just really briefly,
I've never done it. You have to do it with me.
Yeah, exactly, that would kind of be good, because it'll take you a little while to get to where you can do it, and then maybe you and I can do it again and finally cool. beat it. When he started explaining how to do the final boss, and I was like, I can't right now. I can't dedicate this much to my brain to memorizing, like,
no, we'll do it in a couple months.
Which of
It'll
the
chill.
Boss's 16 eyes you have to shoot in what order when they're open. I was just like, I can't do this. So Shattered Throne, though, is really, really neat, and that'll be back in 3 weeks.
That's the dungeon. Okay,
yeah, that's
so
the
what
dungeons.
Is a dungeon in Destiny? So, and make this quick, because people are listening right now being like, oh my god, they've gone into
fucking
Destiny.
Guys. Okay, so really briefly, there's a three-week...
Destiny wormhole.
There's a cool thing going on in the Dreaming City location. We've been discussing this week to week, is how it changes each week. There's an ongoing story of this curse that was unleashed because the boss of the raid unleashed it in her death. Actually, now it's reset to the beginning of the loop, but the NPCs in the Dreaming City are aware that they're in a loop, and so they're saying different lines of dialogue when you go to do stuff. So they'll say, this happened before, and they're confused, and they don't know what's happening. It all seems tied to Savathun. If you remember, Savathun is a hive god.
All right, you're getting too deep. Just talk about the dungeon.
No. This is all important. This is all important. It's all tied to another boss, basically, that's probably going to turn up, and that we're going to have to then fight again. So it's even a bigger narrative that's playing out. So what happens with the Shattered Throne is, on the third week of the cycle, this dungeon opens up that is 590 power requirement, which is even higher than the final boss of the raid.
Oh, my God.
But it's ridiculous. For three people. It's not for six people. And it's complicated, but it's not raid complicated. And it's really, really fucking cool. I mean, I did the first two sections. I didn't beat the second boss. But the first whole section you can do, it's not a big problem. And it's this kind of labyrinth. And you're in the Ascendant Realm, which is this dark, shadow-covered, really striking, looking like mysterious place. And the enemies are really tough. The whole thing feels very Dark Souls. It's got this kind of Anne Orlando feel of a huge cathedral and like a building that was made for creatures that are much larger than you, that you kind of get when you're in Dark Souls. And then there's some platforming and walking across really tight, you know, catwalks that feel very Dark Souls-y. And it has this totally different energy to, or slightly different energy to it. And it's just really beautiful looking and really cool. There's a special emblem you get for doing the whole thing solo, so it's totally soloable, like you can do it. And it's like another, it's somewhere in between a strike and a raid. And it's really cool. I was really, really impressed by it. And it's the kind of thing that,
interesting,
looking back at the Whisper of the Worm quest, which is that timed quest to get that sniper rifle, that kind of feels similar, the way that that was this actually huge, striking, totally new environment, and it was for three people, and it was really hard. I feel like if they're going to wind up doing more dungeons, which I hope they do, and I think they will, that'll kind of get recategorized as a dungeon, so we've kind of had two at this point. But it was neat. I mean, it felt like, in that same way that Gambit feels like something kind of new, this dungeon feels like in PvE world, something just like a new layer for them to explore. So it was
it's funny, in cool. a normal game, like in most games, this would just be par for the course, but because it's Destiny and because it has this history of not doing new things for so long, of always having the same exact rhythms, it's just like, whoa, new stuff, oh my god. Yeah, it just feels so much
it's very cooler. That's very true. Is that work, it's like it's benefiting from low expectations from years of just strikes, the raid, PvP.
It's like we've been fed table scraps for so long, and it's like, oh my god, we get to sit in the chair now.
Like a new dish. What is this? So it does have a lot of that, though it is very neat.
So I will not be playing Destiny much this week or this weekend, even though my wife is out of town, so I have the place to myself to marathon video games, because I will be marathoning something else, and that is a game called Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which I started last night when it came out. And I played for a couple of hours and am already totally enamored of. I love it. Like, love at first sight for this game. It's just everything I wanted. Cassandra, the main character, the female main character, is amazing. The setting is incredible. They made all these improvements on Origins, especially in the combat, that I really, really like. And I just want to be in ancient Greece forever. I'm just ready to just sit and be absorbed by this game. You've also played a couple hours. What do you think?
Yeah, I've played quite a bit, actually. So I started playing yesterday. I should say it came out yesterday, technically, if you pre-ordered it or if you're like press and you got an early copy. It's not actually out until Friday.
No, it's not. It's if you get the more
billion-dollar
versions.
Yeah, gold edition. Yeah. So, which, you know, is... So basically, people who paid a lot of money or people who are in the press get to play it now.
Yes.
Yeah, I like it more, actually, than I thought I would. I got the boat and I'm kind of in the next area and I'm exploring. I'm sort of like entering what feels like the main game, but it's really good. It is, like you said, it refines a lot of things from Origins in ways I wasn't expecting. Already the reintroduction of naval stuff from Black Flag, it just feels a lot better to do that stuff than I thought that it would. I don't know. I want to talk about all of those things, but what do you want to... let's go in order. Let's add some structure to this or something. I have a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, so a couple of things that thoughts that I had.
Okay.
The first thing is that immediately I'm struck by how good the writing and performances are, and they were really good in Assassin's Creed Origins too, and just Bayek was such a good character. But in this, maybe it's because I like the setting more and I'm more into Greece than I was into Egypt, as much as I liked Egypt. But I love Greece. I like grew up reading Greek mythology. I'm way into this stuff. But just having everything just feels very engaging in a way that usually you don't often get from a AAA Ubisoft game. I'm just very hooked in lots of good ways. I really like the humor. I really like Cassandra's interactions with the first dude, Marcos, who's this big goofy...
He's just Cousin Roman. He's straight up Cousin Roman. He's in debt to people he shouldn't be in debt to. He's constantly constantly talking about how his schemes are going to get him out of it. You're sort of his beleaguered enforcer. I was like, God, this guy's so fucking Cousin Roman. Ugh.
Yeah, if they had cell phones, he would be texting you to go bowling with them constantly. I'm just struck by how cool it is, and like the dialogue options are really interesting. I like how they steal The Witcher 3's thing of like white dialogue options are optional, and then yellow advances the story. Mm-hmm. It feels like The Witcher 3 in a lot of ways, as a lot of people have pointed out. So the writing is really good. It just looks fantastic. The thing that has really interested me the most is all the new combat options and the fact that you have abilities, which just adds a lot to what was kind of a mediocre combat system in Origins. Mm-hmm. I imagine that is impressing you too. Aren't you impressed by how good the combat is now?
Yeah. So in terms of the abilities, I'm not totally sure yet because I just don't have that many unlocked, though it does seem like it's going to add a lot of depth. So...
Well, even just being able to kick someone is just makes
do the
it more
Spartan
fun.
Kick. I do think actually that the very, very intro of the game is super bad. Like, I think that it starts with you playing this other guy and you're just in this big stupid fight, and it just is weird. And
it's not just another guy; it's Leonidas.
No, I know, but I mean, you're not playing as one of the main characters, and just that I didn't like that intro, and then immediately liked playing as Cassandra because, like you said, Cassandra is a really cool character. She is. Performed really well. It seems to me like this is going to be a FemShep situation just based on everyone I know who's playing it is just talking about Cassandra and no one is talking about Alexios, and where he's just always going to get short shrift. But she seems really great. I actually appreciate that she's super jacked. Something I noticed in Shadow of the Tomb Raider is that Lara Croft is like more buff now than she used to be because, you know, these women are doing super tough physical stuff and it makes sense. But it's kind of cool that games have begun just being like, yeah, you can have a super buff female character.
It's all because of Nadine from Uncharted and her triceps. She set the bar all these characters.
Yeah, she broke that barrier. I like Cassandra a lot and I do like the writing. And the same thing that Origins did really well, where you start doing a side quest and you learn something cool about some character. There's this one where you find a young woman who says she's descended from Odysseus. Did you do that quest? And it's just a little whatever quest, but it's a really cool thing, and it kind of ties into Cassandra's current quest with, you know, her own father and discovering her own, you know, what that means and her relationship with her ancestry and stuff. And it's just like good writing.
Well, I also think that she'll pop up again.
But even if she doesn't
do a romance, romance her. And I really like that's a good you make me think of a point that I wanted to bring up, which is that I really like that it's set not just in way ancient Greece, but in Peloponnesian War Greece, which is a really cool setting for a number of reasons. One is that, as I think we'll get to, there's some war stuff between Athens and Sparta, which is really interesting. Yeah. But also, they have their own history legends that are way, way in the past for us, legends from like millennia ago for us. But for them, it's still hundreds of years ago. So like Homer writing the Odyssey, that's a legend for them. And Odysseus, that's a legend for them. And so they might know people who claim to be descendants of Odysseus, which is like us meaning people who claim to be descendants of, like, I don't know, Abraham Lincoln or something, where it just feels like ancient history. But to them, it's modern history and also feels like ancient. It's just done really well and interesting. And I'm excited to see how it branches out and where the story goes and all the different directions that it takes.
Yeah, and I'll get to combat in a second. But I also like a lot more than I thought I would. I mean, maybe I would have thought I would have liked this, but I like the branching dialogue options and I like just being engaged in conversations. I mean, there's this sense that I get playing this that I've seen articulated all over the place, that all video games are kind of becoming the same. I mean, that Horizon Zero Dawn and this and The Witcher, I mean, everything is just kind of this vague-ish RPG with branching dialogue and, you know, character creation and stuff. But I like that. I mean, it's cool to have control over conversations. It's cool to feel like even saying, yes, I'll help you, or no, I won't, to someone, even though if you say no, you can just come back and help them later when they're trying to give you a side quest. It's just, it feels kind of cool. It makes it feel like, it just makes me feel more involved in the narrative. And then knowing, you know, there's some decisions that I wasn't really sure about. You know, did the people are sick and they're cleansing this town of the plague, and do you save these people because they seem sympathetic? But if I do that, is it going to cause this whole island to die or something?
I like. And then you can see the consequences, and they're all tied together. I mean, it's very Witcher-y in that. There's one section where at the beginning of the game where if you spare some bandits, then you'll have to fight them in a little bit. And that's kind of a classic video game choice. Do you spare or kill this dude? Mm-hmm. But I'm excited to see how that's kind of like how that expands.
It does, and it raises some funny questions about the animus that I think I wonder. I know is that all of the sort of animus future storyline stuff comes back into play near the end of the game.
Yeah.
And I don't want to know anything about it. And I've told Heather Alexandra, who reviewed it for us, by the way, if you want to know, like, a, you know, just read a good review of this game, read Heather's review on Kotaku. It's, she liked it. And you know, sort of gets into everything about it. But she says apparently that this stuff comes back, which I have always liked that stuff. And I love the idea that if you introduce the idea of choice to the animus, what does that even mean for something that's supposedly coded into your DNA and already happened?
Yeah, I'm sure that's going to be part of the story.
I wonder. I mean, I guess that's so. They could not address it, and I'd be fine with that. If they just are like, whatever, you just have choices now, and it's fine.
I don't know, because that's been the whole conceit of the animus.
Yeah,
is
I know.
That you're playing what actually happened, and that's why if you die, it's not that you die, it's you were desynchronized, because that, or like if you kill a civilian.
I know.
Yeah, so it's, I don't know. I think it'll be part of the story. That's my guess.
The abstract question has always existed because, like, did Ezio buy that trading post or did he not buy that trading post? You know, like,
sure.
It's always there. So I don't know. Like, they don't have to explain it, but it would be kind of cool if they did. So let's talk about mechanical shit. I agree with you about the combat. Did not see that coming. The combat's a lot better. There are a couple of moves in particular that are handled really well. I never liked the combat in Origins. I found it to be kind of weird. Just kind of weird. I don't know. It was floaty. It didn't quite connect in the way that it should. This feels a lot more like just a straight up kind of action RPG fighting game.
Yeah.
So some of that is the way the animations work. The animations seem just really smooth and well done. The parry move is really good, I think. You kind of... Mm-hmm. You know, you have to hit both the shoulder buttons at the right time to do a parry, and the parry is a parryable attack is signaled with a flash. And that's not exactly how it's worked in past Assassin's Creed games. Obviously, Assassin's Creed games and parrying have this whole really complicated history. They've tried a million different ways to do it. There have been games where you have to time your parry. I think actually Assassin's Creed 3 introduced this, but even then it didn't quite work. And a lot of the games, the earlier ones, the Ezio games, you would kind of just hold block and then block every attack, and then when someone attacked you, would just press the parry button and you'd like instantly kill them. So this is now very different. But it is, so that I think that's really cool. The abilities seem cool. I don't have that many unlocked, but I like that you have these kind of super abilities that you're always kind of building up to, where in Origins, it was kind of just like you had this one super ability you could do if your adrenaline bar got maxed out, and that would let you kill someone. And that was cool, but
this is a way better
system. It feels a lot better. And so I wasn't expecting that, and so I like fighting, though I also like, in terms of the abilities, they kind of railroad you, or they force you to specialize more. You kind of have to, like, your armor gives you bonuses to assassination power, or stealth, you know, mobility, or combat strength, and it's, you know, if you're wearing kind of Spartan armor, you're, like, a stronger fighter, or if you're wearing a cool kind of stealth outfit, you're a better sneaker, and I like that it's kind of...
Yeah, you have to make actual decisions.
Yeah.
You can't just go with what, at least if you're playing on harder difficulties, and
right.
It warns you at the beginning, like, if you play on hard, you will have to make decisions, optimal decisions about equipment in order to increase your efficiency.
Actually, so, yeah, and I like that you have to kind of make a character build. Are you playing on hard or on normal?
Normal, but I might switch to hard because I found it pretty easy.
Yeah, so I'm kind of struggling right now because I'm going back and forth between the two, and here's my struggle. On hard, in general, I like it a lot better. I felt this way about Origins too, like sneaking and fighting, you really don't want to get spotted. You can't really easily fight five or six people that are your level. The level scaling is more aggressive too, so the enemies keep up with you, I think, more aggressively is what Steven Totillo said. But in the boat, on the ocean, at least right now, my boat is so not upgraded that on hard, it's just ridiculous. And I totally just get ruined and can't. It's just not fun or doable. Like, I just can't do what are supposed to be kind of basic side quests, you know, go blow up three ships. I tried to do it on hard and I was just getting ruined. And, you know, even if you board the ship, you get on there and then you're fighting six guys and you can't do it. So I'm kind of struggling. I wish there were a sort of nautical difficulty versus, I guess after playing Shadow of the Tomb Raider with all those variable difficulty settings, I wish there were more different.
You're spoiled on that. Yeah, I think that, playing on normal, but I fought that first bounty hunter who chases you around. He's level 5, and I fought him on level 4, and that was a really fun, like, really satisfying, challenging fight to defeat. I had to dodge around and avoid all his attacks and kill all the dudes he summons. And so, I beat him one level below what I should have been, and that was really cool. So, maybe maybe I'll just keep doing
the,
that.
The frustrating thing is that you can't change the difficulty without reloading. So, like, you can't just change it in the middle of the game. Otherwise, I would totally just toggle back and forth. If I'm doing a ship battle, I'd go to normal and do hard everywhere else. Because, yeah, I do recommend hard for everything else. It's way more fun. You just have to use your whole bag of tricks and everything.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, I might do that. So, I want to, speaking of difficulty settings, I assume you're playing on exploration mode versus guided mode. So, a little bit of context in case you haven't seen this. Guided mode, there are two. Before you start the game, it asks you if you want to play in guided mode or exploration mode. Guided mode is what Origins did. It's putting waypoints on everything. You see big yellow markers everywhere.
Yeah.
Exploration mode, which is the game says, this is the way that Assassin's Creed or Odyssey is meant to be played. That instead of giving you markers, it gives you kind of hints, and they're always very obvious hints from what we've seen so far of like, this is going to be this next thing.
They're
it's
italicized.
On the eastern side. Yeah, it's on the southern
south
side
of
Ithaca
island.
Or whatever. Yeah. So it, when you look at your map, you have to set a waypoint and figure out where to go on your own, which I found really cool and interesting and a really good way to play the game. And hopefully it gets more challenging as you go. But every time you get close to your waypoint, you still get that friggin' message saying you have to summon your bird and use them to find everything, and it doesn't go away.
I have exciting news for you that I just saw on the Assassin's Creed subreddit a couple hours ago. If you turn off the tips, like if you turn off the tips and whatever advice setting in the in one of the options for the game, it makes that go away. So it turns away all of the tips and tutorials.
Wait, hold on. But Steven's article about the differences between Odyssey and Origins on Kotaku the other day, it said that the developers told him that you can't turn
Let me explain the full thing. So what the developers meant by that was that you can't completely make that go away. It's not Senyu, what's it? Ikaros. Ikaros does not spot things for you setting. The system is still there, but it removes just that tooltip of press the button to summon your bird to see it. So apparently I think there's a vibration, and it's still there, so if you summon the bird, it'll still spot the thing for you. But it doesn't give you that annoying pop-up, which I'm leaving those on for now just because there's enough new systems in this game that I want it to kind of explain to me what to do. But I can definitely see turning that off being
So the thing I want is that to appear and then disappear. Like, I want one prompt that says, oh, okay, I know that I'm in the area now. And then I want it to go away because I don't necessarily always want to use him to figure out where everything is.
So now I think you'll just have to, if your controller will vibrate and it'll kind of tell you that way, I guess.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to play with that. Get back to you. So yeah, we should move on because we're both very early into this.
Wait,
game
one other thing before we move on. One other thing that I want to point out that I think some listeners might not know about that I didn't know about until I read Steven's comparison article between Origins and Odyssey. That's really cool. Uh-huh. There's an entire fucking nemesis system in this game that like I didn't know was in this game. So the nemesis system from Shadow of War and Shadow of Mordor is in this game, basically, there's this mercenaries system.
Well, it's a little different because they don't
come back
to life when you kill
them. I'm going to explain it. So it, in a lot of ways, is very similar. So there are
and
these...
they don't like. I got killed by one, and he didn't. I expected him to like get more powerful, but he didn't.
Right. But so there are these mercenaries that you come across, and you, of course, are also a mercenary. So it's already different in that you're on the spectrum in this system, like you're placed alongside these other mercenaries. And each one has kind of a different name, and they all have different traits, so they have strengths and weaknesses. Maybe they're weak to ranged attacks and strong against fire or something. And you'll get they factor into the game, I think, in all kinds of different ways. You know, so far I've only had them. One will be sort of dispatched after me if I, you know, steal too much stuff. Mm-hmm. But they have all kinds of different purposes, and you can go hunt them down yourself, and that makes you more notorious. And
there's a whole quest attached.
Yeah, there's a whole thing attached to it, which is sort of similar to the Falakis in Origins. It's just like a much more fleshed out and I think better system. I like the Falakis. I did that whole quest. I thought it was pretty cool. But this is, you know, so you go into the menu and you see this hierarchy of mercenaries, and the ones you haven't met are sort of in shadow, just like, it looks exactly like in Shadow of Mordor. And then, like you said, it is different. Like, if you get killed by one, there isn't this sort of, your death isn't built into the fiction, and they don't they don't become more powerful and less powerful. But they do turn up and kind of ruin your day all the time. That one guy who follows you around the first island is a nightmare while you're still level 2 and he's level 5. And he kept, I would be in the middle of a side quest and then that guy would just come walking in. I'd be like, fuck, I have to go hide for a while, which I just sort
this
of...
This really proves your point that all AAA video games are the same.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It's one more system from another
you
game.
You should write an article that's like a checklist for AAA open world games, and it's like, or AAA games, and it's like open world, yep, skill trees,
Nemesis
dialogue
system.
Options, yeah. Side quests that are have their own.
What's the one that Mark Brown, the Game Maker's Toolkit guy, pointed this out, which has been pointed out before, but which is that every single game now has 3 skill trees that have names like warrior,
hunting,
you know, hunter,
warrior.
or whatever.
Well, it's always one is combat, one is like stealthish stuff or like dexterity based stuff. It's always like if you think of them as D&D stats, it's always like strength, dexterity, and then like I guess wisdom
or like gadgets. Sometimes it's sort of the gadget tree in The Witcher. Yeah. Or in Origins, it was that way.
Yes, all video games are exactly the same because they are all $100 million productions and they need to sell. And if they don't sell, they're all fucked. And so they can't take any risks and they have to be conservative and just make the same decisions that they know work. That's video games for you. That's AAA game development for you. On that note, why don't we take a break and then we will talk about the news of the week.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life 1 week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. So, Kirk, we have been experimenting a little bit, and you and Maddie experimented a little bit with news and how we want to do the news segment, and we're still going to be playing around and seeing what works. We got a lot of feedback that people definitely want some sort of a news segment, so we're going to keep playing with different things, and I don't know, we'll figure it out. Keep emailing us at splitscreen@kotaku.com or tweeting at us with your feedback, and we always appreciate just hearing from everybody on their thoughts on the structure of the show. So with that in mind, let's talk about some news that happened over the past week. First and foremost, Harry Potter. Kirk, you and I are both big Harry Potter fans, correct?
Yes, correct. We have our big Buckbeak theory, remember? I feel like that was a watershed moment for Kotaku, our theory about Newt Scamander.
Although I think I guess it hasn't really been disproven, mm-hmm. but it certainly was not supported
we'll
by
still
the,
see. We'll
the
see.
Movie.
I'm holding
Fantastic
out hope.
Beasts movie. For the new one comes out soon. Maybe that'll be the big twist of mm-hmm. Fantastic Beasts suit. So Harry Potter has had a long history in video games. There have been a lot of Harry Potter video games. Recently, there have not. There hasn't really been a proper Harry Potter video game since like the PS2 era. But that's going to change soon because on Tuesday, there was a leaked footage from a Redditor who said that they were approached in a mall and asked to come watch footage of this game and like do a mini focus test. And so they snuck footage of the game with their phone and shot it.
How does that work? Just someone comes up to you in the mall and is like, hey, you want to come see a video game?
Yeah, I guess so. The way that I envision it is publisher is doing these tests, hires a third-party marketing firm. That marketing firm just has tentacles, like branches all around the country.
Just have like unmarked vans.
And just survey
at
random
malls.
People. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they just pay people to go survey other people. And the other option here, by the way, is that this was an intentional leak by the developer and maybe they haven't been officially greenlit yet and they wanted to survey interest, public interest, and get that to
This is like how the this is like how the White House currently operates.
Yes, very, very possible. Yeah, someone I was talking to suggested that theory, and I was like, that's some Game of Thrones shit right there. But yeah, so Harry Potter footage leaked. At first, people thought it was Rocksteady, but I can assure you that it is not. I have a pretty good idea of what Rocksteady is working on, and it's a superhero game that is not Harry Potter. And Harry Potter is the theory that people are having right now that I believe is true just based on the buzz that I've heard is that it's made by Avalanche Software, not to be confused with Avalanche Studios. Yes, there are two different companies and games called Avalanche.
Look, there are only so many names, okay? There aren't that many names.
In fairness, yeah, there are only so many games. So someone should go with Split Screen Studios. So these are the guys who made Disney Infinity for a while under Disney. Disney shut them down in 2016. Then Warner Brothers kind of revived them, bought them to make the Cars 3 game that came out a little while ago, and now we believe that they're working on this for a number of reasons. First and foremost, because they had job listings that were looking for writers who knew how to write British dialogue and grammar. It adds up. It makes sense. So from the buzz that we're hearing, this is very early on in production. Might be a next-gen game. Maybe like 2020, something like that. I thought the footage looked really cool. I got really excited about it. You were a little more tempered, correct?
Yeah, I didn't think it looked that cool. I don't know. Like, I feel like a buzzkill, I guess, but it didn't excite me very much. I do like Harry Potter. I guess I'd love a good Harry Potter video game. It seems like that world and that fiction would lend itself to the trappings of what we expect from a video game. That was just kind of what I felt like I was looking at. Oh, yeah, okay, it's a Harry Potter video game, all right. It just, you know, it didn't look particularly groundbreaking or amazing. It was just Harry Potter stuff, and the Harry Potter music plays, and that's cool. But it looked kind of like the other Harry Potter video games. I didn't see why anyone was excited. Like, if that had been a trailer instead of a leak, I don't know that people would have been as excited.
So a couple of things. First of all, for people who haven't watched the footage, and you can go watch it, there's a mirror link on Kotaku, even though it was pulled from YouTube. So it kind of flashes between a bunch of different clips. There's no real long period of gameplay. It's just 2-second clips, segments of a bunch of different stuff. So you see like a dude doing alchemy in a classroom, and then another dude walking in the garden, and then people in the Forbidden Forest, and all sorts of random stuff. And I think part of it is that people like me are just filling in the blanks in our head and just imagining playing as this. According to the dude who leaked it, it's going to, you create your own character, and you're like this fifth year student who is a transfer student to Hogwarts, so it's that way before Harry Potter time. So people like me, I'm just like envisioning this like Bully like combination, like Harry Potter game, very heavily inspired by Bully, and you play in the classroom and you have to make cool decisions, and it's got some Persona in there, and maybe there's social links, and I'm just envisioning that. And here's the thing, here's the big case for this game, and obviously we have not seen it, we don't know anything about it, uh-huh. But here's why I'm excited. So in the PS2 era, licensed games were crappy. There were a ton of licensed games. Most of them were not very good. There were a lot of movie tie-ins. There were a lot of random franchise tie-ins. It was a lot of companies.
I mean, there have been a lot of bad licensed Harry Potter video games.
Yes, yes, exactly. Since the beginning of this generation, that has not happened anymore. Companies do not make bad licensed games anymore. They're very rare. You don't see them very often. The companies that were that kind of made their names on those games, the Midways and the THQs of the world, do not exist anymore because that was not a lucrative or viable business model. And these days, if you're doing a licensed property, and we see this with Spider-Man, we see this with Lord of the Rings and Shadow of War.
Who did this first were Rocksteady with Arkham Asylum. I mean, that was the
exactly. I was getting there. These companies are doing it right, and they're putting a lot of care and really good treatment and making really good video games out of licensed properties. So I can see, like, everyone assumes that if there's a new Harry Potter open world AAA RPG game, it's not going to be another licensed cash-in. It's going to be something along the lines of Shadow of Mordor, where this company comes in and is like, hey, we're not doing just another fucking movie tie-in. We're treating this right with the respect it deserves. And so that's why I think that a lot of people saw a lot of really cool potential with that trailer. Like, the trailer itself is just like, whatever, it's just a bunch of random scenes. It's not showing you anything concrete, probably because it was never meant to see the light of day. But you fill in the blanks and you imagine, like, by today's standard, like we said before, all AAA video games are the same. So imagine a Harry Potter game that's, like, hitting all those checklists. I'm really excited about that, especially if they take from Bully, and I'm sure they will.
Yeah, I hope it's good. I mean, like you said, it's a trailer. Nothing I saw in that trailer, like, jumped out at me as being particularly new as a thing. It was like,
okay, let me put it another way. I'm not excited for the trailer.
I almost hesitate. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, let me put it another way. I'm not excited for the trailer. I'm excited for the idea of Harry Potter being revived as a AAA next-gen open world game. Like, that's what's exciting to me, just that they're making a really good Harry Potter game.
Sure.
That's what I want.
Yeah, I would just be more excited, I think, if I had heard that and not seen this trailer than having seen the trailer. It just looked like a Harry Potter video game to me, so...
Okay, fair enough. Let's move on. There's lots more news to talk about. Google streaming service, finally official. Project Yeti, which I reported on a while back and was had been rumored. It is now official in the most low-key Google way possible. They were just like, oh, yeah, Project Stream.
I love that it's called Project Stream.
I'm sure it's their temporary name for it. I'm sure they'll give it a proper name in the future. But still, it's them saying, hey, starting Friday, people who get into this test will be able to play Assassin's Creed Odyssey in Google Chrome. And the big red flag is that they're looking for people with a 25 megabit per second internet connection or higher. So that itself just says, like, what the big challenge that they have ahead of them. But still, it's cool to see them finally talking about it. And I'm excited to see the next phases of Google's big gaming plan, because they have a lot of big ambitious plans for gaming, including, as I reported back in June, this is kind of the first prong. They also are working on a platform or a console of some sort. Not really clear on whether it's a like heavy next gen super high spec console or something more like a Chromecast that supports Project Stream. I think it's more like the latter. And they're also looking to buy and invest in development of actual games themselves. So I'm very interested to see what happens from this. What do you think? Are you going to stream games in your Google Chrome tabs?
No. I mean, I'd be interested if it works, but I'm not really the target audience. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. It seems like all of the non-gaming tech giants still haven't quite figured this out, or at least Amazon sure didn't. So maybe Google will. Who knows?
Yeah, Amazon's still trying. They're still hoping to ship games. I think they're aiming for next year for
it's all kind of goes to show game. That you can't just throw money at this. Like, it requires something more than just money, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, it requires, I think it's all about leadership at the top and just like being willing to commit to gaming and just go all in, as opposed to just being like, oh yeah, we're going to do this and throw some money at it.
I guess it's just that there's an artistic component to video games that there isn't really with, you know, a Maps application or something. Like, mm-hmm. It's like becoming a music distributor or something in that way that none of these companies necessarily do. Like, they sell the thing, but they don't necessarily make the thing. And, you know, Amazon figured that out. Amazon makes good movies and makes good TV shows now. So it's possible, yeah. that they could figure out how to make good games too. It just seems like maybe the people making decisions at some of those companies don't yet fully understand who they need to make the things that people will want to play.
Yeah, something people don't think about a lot or talk about a lot is team chemistry, and the band comparison is apt there. And I think that if you look at some of the most successful studios, you'll see a lot of people who have been working together for a long time,
yeah.
and know each other's tics and know what each other like. And you see a lot of successful studios, like one that immediately comes to mind is Yacht Club Games, the people who made Shovel Knight, and they were really successful right out of the gate because they all came from working together at another company and we're just like, hey, we want to make games together. And it was very, very band-like. I think team chemistry is something that money cannot create. That's something you can only create with a lot of time and a lot of good people just like who like and respect and want to work with each other. And I think that definitely has an impact that there's no tangible way to measure. Let's talk about some more news. So this is a crazy story. Over the weekend, the Dallas Morning News reported that Gearbox CEO Randy Pitchford had hired an assistant named Jonathan Wright Martin, and he has disappeared. And the Pitchfords say that he stole $3 million worth of property from them while working as their assistant. And this is wild. He apparently, go read the Dallas Morning News story because it's really wild. But basically, he was, according to Pitchford, Martin was like forging checks and making ATM withdrawals and stealing on a credit card and donating money to charities and chartering a private jet and doing all this stuff with the finances of a coffee shop that Randy Pitchford's wife owns. So just a really wild story. It's one of those stories that I think when the full details come out, maybe in like a magazine story or something like that, or maybe even a Kotaku feature, it'll be one of those like too good to be real, like crime crazy stories that is immediately optioned for a movie and is just super fascinating.
Yeah, I don't have a ton of thoughts on this one other than that is a lot of money to steal, and it sounds like it was a whole involved elaborate racket. So I'm glad they caught the guy and figured it out. I hope they figure out how to get their money back, or at least some of it.
Yeah, jeez. Yeah, I don't think you can in that circumstance. Like, what do you even do if he doesn't have it? How do you even do it? Another wild story from over the weekend, or Friday actually. So Valve, as we know, Valve is actually releasing a video game soon. It's not the video game that anyone wanted, but still, Valve is releasing a card game.
Some people might want it.
Sure. Valve is releasing a card game called Artifact, and I guess some people want it. And over on Friday, they announced a card. I guess they've been kind of doing a trickle of card announcements on their Twitter feed. They announced this card called Crack the Whip, and I'm going to read you the description for Crack the Whip. It says, modify a black hero with, after you play a black card, give this hero and its ally neighbors +2 attack this round. And obviously when they talk about black hero, they're talking about the color in the game, like the mana color. Magic the Gathering is the same sort of thing. But somehow nobody thought about the implications of naming a card Crack the Whip and talking about modifying a black hero. Like somehow this just got through. Like I was baffled when I saw that nobody looked at that and was like, what?
I would say that this is an example of why diversity is important, and it is in a way. Like, it's important to have people who aren't just white people who would see something like that and immediately say, wait, that's fucked up. But also, anyone should look at that and say, wait, that's fucked up.
That's what's crazy.
I would
like,
think
you
by
don't...
now. So
yeah.
Maybe it's an argument for just, like, diversity in life and just people being aware of that kind of thing? Because come on. Yeah.
I'm just baffled. Yeah. Like that. I wonder if it's just they were tired and like grinding out a bunch of cards.
Or like two people saw it and neither of those people thought of it. And, you know, clearly they immediately realize, oh, fuck, and they're changing it. So I guess
The second part of the story is then they announced in the most Valve way possible. A few hours later, they tweeted, "We are changing the name of Crack the Whip to Coordinated Assault." We changed the name of Crack the Whip to Coordinated Assault. And that was the full tweet. That's all they said. They don't say, sorry, Valve. They didn't say. Yeah, it's very Valve. It's not like acknowledging a mistake. It's just, we changed it. Now it looks a little bit different. But yeah, I'm just baffled at how, like, yeah, and obviously a lot of these companies need to be more diverse, and I think a person of color might look at that and be more inclined to be like, holy shit, what the fuck? But I feel like anyone should have had that reaction.
Yeah.
One more news story for the week. Sony has announced that there will not be a PlayStation Experience this year. Nothing too deep to talk about here other than the fact that there's no PlayStation Experience this year, which is... kind of a big shift for them. They've been doing it for 6 or 7 years now and having a big conference where they announce stuff. But I'm guessing that because they don't have a lot more to talk about other than the games that we know are coming, and they just want to save a couple, the few remaining announcements they have for this life cycle, I think they're saving for other events. They usually do like a Paris Games Week conference, and then obviously E3 of next year they'll have to save some stuff for. I think... some people have taken this as a sign that the PlayStation 5 is coming next year, and they're holding off so they can like do some PlayStation meeting in January or February or something like that. I do not think that's the case. I talked to a lot of game developers about this sort of stuff, and the general belief that I've heard is that next gen is still pretty far off, like 2020. I don't really see that as a sign. What about you? Do you think we're getting next gen consoles next year?
No, because you said that and you know more than I do. It is funny that 2020 is not actually that far off. It's like actually pretty soon. The year after next, and this year is almost over. So it's actually not even that far away. So
yeah, already been a long time since the PlayStation 5 and Xbox One came out, or PlayStation 4 and Xbox One came out.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird that it's been 5 years. It's been very long.
And it feels like shorter. It feels like they're new still, to me at least.
Yeah, but it feels like, it feels like we're at that sweet spot now. Like, games like Spider-Man feel like they're, you know, really, or these Assassin's Creed games we're playing too, they feel like they're really in that, okay, everyone really knows how to get the most out of these consoles and make them, you know, just really sing. And that's always a nice, I like this time, this place, so I'm fine with it. But yeah, I think that tracks. We know they've got The Last of Us 2, Days Gone. You know, maybe they have one big announcement to make, but they want to save that for E3, so it makes sense to me.
Yeah, yeah, and I think they still have at least a couple of other PS4 things, maybe nothing as big as these other first-party games, because if you think about, like, their first-party studios, a lot of them have moved on, so, like, Sony Santa Monica is most likely working on God of War 2 for the PlayStation 5. The big question that I have, and I'm very fascinated to see whether companies go cross-gen for this coming generation, and whether they repeat the mistake that they made last time where they were hampering their games by forcing developers to release them also on PS3 and Xbox 360. And that wound up not only hurting developers by forcing them to kind of like restrain themselves and release on multiple platforms at once, but also those games didn't sell. Like I heard when I was reporting for my book on Dragon Age Inquisition, I believe off the top of my head, I believe it was like they sold 90% of copies on current gen and PC and like 10% or something like that. It was either 10 or 20% on PS3 and Xbox 360. And they were like, in retrospect, we would definitely not have gone cross-gen. Mm. So I wonder if people will make the same mistakes.
Well, we're in this kind of slightly different world now where there's the PS4 Pro and the Xbox One X. And so, you know, the Xbox One X is still a pretty friggin' mighty console that I don't think is really getting used to the utmost of its performance. PS4 Pro feels a little more like it's kind of at least getting worked by some of these current games. But yeah, if you buy one of those now, the Xbox One X isn't that old. And then suddenly they're like, oh yeah, surprise, Xbox Two. No games. You know, you're going to have to get this if you want to play the new games.
So my thought is that my kind of educated speculation, and we've talked about this before, but I'll just repeat the same thing I said a few months ago. My thought is that with Sony, we'll see a proper generational leap where you get a PlayStation 5. There's some games that only run on PlayStation 5, and that's the end of it. And it also plays PS4 games if you want, but there's some games that are only PS5. And then with the Xbox, I think they'll go for more of the iPhone model, where it's now you get an Xbox 2 or whatever it is, and we have games that run really well on Xbox 2, and they'll also run on Xbox One X, but they won't run on Xbox One. So like Xbox One X is the new baseline. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, they release a new Xbox, and suddenly Xbox One X is no longer the new baseline. Xbox 2 is the new baseline. And so now you can get games that'll run on Xbox 2 and Xbox 2X. And then it keeps going from there where it's an iterative
model.
Yeah,
that tracks with the general approach to backward compatibility that they've taken too, like where mm-hmm. there's this just sense that now if you have an Xbox, you can play every Xbox game from forever. Basically, I know there's some that don't work, but...
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And that's nice. I think so. I'd wish Sony would do that instead. Mm-hmm. It would be really shitty. This would actually surprise me if the PS5 didn't play PS4 games.
It will. I'm pretty confident it will.
They're not going to do that again, I don't think. I mean, Sony does some dumb shit.
Well,
but I don't
part
think
of it was the
that.
Whole cell architecture thing, and it was just technically difficult for them to make that happen. Yeah. So, yeah, no, they're not going to do that again. That would be unfathomably stupid, and they have this huge library of incredible games now. And
I mean, these companies occasionally do unfathomably stupid things, but I agree.
That's true.
It's probably not going to happen.
All right. That's it for the news. Why don't we take another break, and then we will spoil Spider-Man.
Can't wait.
And we are back to spoil the hell out of the adventures of Peter Parker. This is your warning. We are going to spoil the new game. We are going to talk about the whole story. Turn back now if you do not want to be spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Aunt May dies. Miles Morales becomes Spider-Man. Doc Ock is the main villain. Sinister Six. What else? What else is there to spoil? Harry isn't really in Europe. Norman is going to become the Green Goblin next game. Good twist, by the way, Harry not being in Europe. I enjoy that.
Oh, I saw that one coming, but I guess that was an okay twist.
Yeah, maybe it's because I didn't read the comics, but I thought the story was full of surprises and interesting. Anyway, you have finally finished Spider-Man. I finished Spider-Man a while ago. I loved it. It might be my favorite game of the year. Kirk, did you love it as much as I did?
I don't know, because I can't put a number on how much you loved it. I liked it a lot. I thought it was good.
17 and a half.
17 and a half, just out of whatever.
Out of five,
I thought it was really good, and I thought it was really
interesting. 17.5 divided by 5 is my number.
Okay, got it. I thought it was good. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was well made. I thought the story was really well performed, kind of better performed than it was written at times, in terms of just some aspects of the characters that I guess we can get into in a minute. They've got a really good baseline here to build on. And I think as much as I've been constantly comparing these games with the Arkham games, because they are such an obvious sort of, they're so inspired by those and they carry on and then do things differently in some ways so that it just makes me want to compare them naturally. It's also, you know, comparing them to Arkham games is comparing a series that had years and years and 3 entries to really mature into Arkham Knight, just mechanically and, you know, in terms of design. And, you know, this is the first entry where... Mm-hmm. Insomniac is benefiting from all the work that Rocksteady did on those 3 games, so they are. It's not like you're comparing this to Arkham Asylum exactly, but they are kind of different in that way.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of comparisons there and a lot of thoughts that I think are interesting and instructive, and some ways that I do think the Arkham games are still like greatly outperforming Spider-Man. But then I really like Spider-Man overall. So,
by the way, a side note, if you think about how rare it is for a new IP to just hit the mark right out of the gate, that's kind of mixing metaphors for, yeah. for a new IP to get number
do better,
one,
do better, Jason,
to win the race right out of the gate. If you think of how rare that is, between Horizon Zero Dawn and now Spider-Man, man, it's that's
well. I mean,
incredible.
You know what other game did that is Batman: Arkham Asylum. I mean, that game.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
landed
that's a very
just
good point.
Was amazing. Like, and yep. No one could believe it. I remember even the lead up to that game, thinking this isn't going to be good, and then it was fucking awesome, and being like, whoa. I mean, a lot of people still say that's the best one in that series.
Yep.
So, a thing that I really liked. Let's talk about the story maybe first.
Yeah.
I love the characters, the good guys in this in particular, a lot. I think Yuri Lowenthal deserves all the plaudits in the
Oscars.
World for his performance as Peter Parker.
The Game
I just
Awards.
Think he's such a, as an actor, he has been in the scene forever. He's been in a million games. He's been in every game you play, like every JRPG you've ever played. He's been in it. He was the Prince of Persia. He's just in so many different things. And he's one of those voice actors who's just been doing this forever, but there hasn't ever been a game for him to just really get to show the range and the emotions and the relatability that he got to as Peter. And I think he just did an amazing job. I think that, I wrote a post about that text message scene. I think it's just wonderful. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the writing and the way he's written and then the way he plays the part that's just super relatable. And he's just this very relatable character. I talked about this when we talked about the game before, but how funny it is that this weirdo superhero with these weird spider abilities somehow is still the most relatable superhero, but he is. And I thought he was great. And I thought that he did a great job. With like their relationship with MJ was really good.
That's my favorite part is their relationship is just the text message you scene that you wrote about is just my overall highlight of the game. And yeah, that's what made me enjoy it the most is just the tension between the two of them and just the it just felt very real and true.
Fun fact that I didn't know until I looked up the IMDb of this game is that Laura Bailey actually played MJ, and she was Nadine in Uncharted Lost Legacy.
Uncharted 4. Miss Triceps herself.
Yeah, so she's actually playing a totally different character in this, but she's also in this, which I thought was really cool. And then that Yuri Lowenthal's wife plays Yuri, the cop who is named Yuri. I thought that was really
cool. That's incredibly confusing.
Yes, I'm sure they had quite a bit of fun with that.
Yeah. You might remember that a month ago when we were first talking about this, I was like, yeah, MJ and Peter's relationship is by far the highlight of the game. I wasn't so sold by Miles. I thought he was just fine, but he was just too much of a mirror.
He gets that
Peter
one
Parker
scene
for me.
The scene where Peter shows him how to fight is a really wonderful scene,
and
just
he punches
his
him.
Acting
yeah.
in that, where he's like, "You're Spider-Man. You're the amazing Spider-Man. You're the incredible." Like that, he really is amazing. The actor who played him, who actually is the guy, his name is. Wait, let me look him up. He played the Sam in The Last of Us, the boy in The Last of Us. His name is, wait, let me find him. Najee Jeter. And Tara Platt also, she played Yuri. So that's Yuri Lowenthal's wife. Her name is Terry Platt. So all these actors, it's a whole constellation of actors who are in everything.
So you mentioned the heroes, but I actually like the villains a lot too, especially Otto Octavius. And so at first I was like, at first when you're first introduced to the fact that Peter works in his lab, I was like, oh, okay, great. They're setting us up to have Doc Ock be the main villain, whatever. But then as the game went on and it became this tragedy of like you actually connecting the wires and creating this neural interface for Doc Ock and turning him into Doc Ock yourself. I thought it was this really cool, well-handled, ironic tragedy that I was really into by the end. And just hearing Doc Ock talk about his physical ailments and his his desire to escape the frailty of his body, I was way into that. And him as a villain was very tragic, I thought.
So yeah, so in terms of Peter and MJ, and actually in terms of Doc Ock, I think that the execution was better for me than the conception sometimes. Like the idea of the superhero girlfriend who wants to be taken seriously as a contributing member of the team, and of the superhero who realizes that he's better with the non-super people helping him. I mean, these are beats that have been covered in a million things. And while they did it really well, and it's a cool thing to do with the previously damsel and distressed, girlfriend to make her an active part of the story, it's still kind of just the first next step. And I'd I'm ready for them to like do even more ambitious and interesting things with those characters. But like you said, like they did it really well. The thing I liked about the Otto story, which didn't like do that much for me, actually, I mean, it was fine, I guess, but I really liked how at the very beginning of the game, the first thing you do is you come in and Otto is having this experiment go wrong and you think, oh, we're going to see Doc Ock get created right now. And then instead he's like, oh, never mind, I'm fine. And then you spend most of the rest of the game with him not being Doc Ock and kind of watching him more slowly become him, which I think was a smart move, clearly a very deliberate one, that they wanted to have at least one villain become a villain where every other villain had already become a villain, you know, and mm-hmm. they were really established. I think in general for me, and here's an Arkham comparison, I think that the villains in the Arkham games are so much more interesting than the villains in this game. I just think like every one of, like, I mean, it's not almost not fair because Batman just has better villains than any superhero.
Yeah, elaborate.
Well, so yeah, they're working with what they're working with, but I still think that the Joker-Batman relationship throughout the three of those games, and in particular in Arkham Knight, and the way that that's explored and the way that it allows Batman, like it creates this nightmare version of Batman, is in one way, and only in one way, more appealing to me. And that's just in that it's this really high concept kind of Sturm and Drang, almost operatic view of like psychosis and a person's personality and all this really high concept shit. And they execute it in this incredibly ambitious way that I really like. Even while something we've talked about before, the human factors in Spider-Man are really great. When Peter is sort of pleading with Otto to come back to himself, and he's like anguished over the guilt he feels, that to me is really compelling because Yuri Lowenthal's performance is so good and it's so well written, even though the actual high concept of it is way less interesting than, you know, just because it's not as high, it's much lower concept. It's just, oh, this
right.
guy
I mean, by
guy.
Definition, Spider-Man is a grounded superhero and he's by definition going to be low concept as opposed to Batman, who's this billionaire, like fucked up psychopath who's battling his own inner demons and sometimes literally.
I think that stuff is interesting. And then also just the Riddler. So one thing that I really didn't care for in this Spider-Man game were the puzzles and any of the stuff that wasn't either swinging around or like combat. The puzzles and the stealth both just didn't do much for me, having played the shit out of all the Arkham games and seen mm-hmm. how much they
but
can do
But it's part of
that.
The video game checklist is like diverse mechanics, so you have something else to do
right.
other than
and like,
swing
so,
and fight.
Right, and you mentioned how Peter kind of helps Doc Ock build the thing, but even so, you're just doing a fucking pipe dream minigame. I mean, every time I was doing that, I just kind of was like, this is just a dumb diversion to keep me...
You can't skip them.
Yeah, so compared to the Riddler trophies, and the Riddler is just a perfect video game villain, right? I mean, is there a better video game villain than a guy who leaves puzzles all around the place for you to solve and is obsessed with making you solve puzzles? I mean, no, he's perfect for a video game. So it's not even really fair, but... you know, there's a guy like that, the mysterious guy leaving challenges around for Spider-Man, but those just aren't as cool. I mean, the Riddler puzzles in the Arkham games are amazing, some of them. Like, they're like Zelda-level, incredible puzzles built into the environment and all, and each one is unique and distinct, and they're just, they require all kinds of different stuff. One thing I really like that the Arkham games do that I think the Spider-Man games could start to do is they make some of the puzzles about finding clues about like lore from past stories. So, you know, you'll find the cane owned by the guy who started Arkham Asylum or whatever. And I like that a lot. And they could have leaned into that a little bit more than they did in Spider-Man, which, and I would imagine they will in the future. But so there isn't, it's missing some of that where the other villains, you know, like, I don't know, Scorpion, like whatever, Scorpion, Vulture, like who gives a shit? It's some old guy in like wings, like whatever. He's kind of, you know, he's just not as cool as Scarecrow or
Well,
or whatever.
It's funny you say that because Vulture is so good in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah, that was for, you know, sort of similar, it's some sort of similar reasons, like the way that they wrote the character and the way they gave him a good backstory.
Point is that they can make any of these villains into really compelling.
Right, but
characters.
I guess in order to make them cool, they can only do it by making the backstory interesting and making the character interesting. The villain archetype itself isn't actually that cool and doesn't give you that much to work with, where Batman just is working with villains who tend to just be more interesting and kind of force different kinds
So Spider-Man's, and again, this is spoken as a movie person, not a comic person, but Spider-Man's most interesting villain, I think, is Venom, and they're saving him clearly for the next game, because at the end of the game, you see this little flash
right?
of the symbiote in Harry's tank. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That little blah. that's hitting the edge of it. Oh yeah, I definitely think there's a reason that that suit isn't in the game, and it's very clearly being set up for like the symbiote to make some sort of appearance, and so I think Venom will definitely be in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible. I don't think it's very clear. I think it's possible, but I think that to tease Green Goblin and Venom at the same time is kind of weird. So it could just be he's Green Goblin and he's a weird version of Green Goblin.
I don't think so. I think they're both going to be in the next game, and they're both going to, and those are both two iconic Spider-Man villains who we haven't seen yet in this game. So, and those are two of the better Spider-Man villains, I would say, just based on my own limited experience. Batman does have that really interesting cast of villains around him, and yeah, Spider-Man didn't give us the time to. Yeah, and yeah, you make a really good point about the concept of the villain, like the concept of Rhino and Scorpion and Vulture is just like whatever, who cares?
Right, and that's really like not to get too bogged down with the Batman stuff. It's more just to point out the way that a lot of the actual Sinister Six stuff I thought was sort of disappointing. Mm-hmm. Even Mr. Negative, they it was better because they kind of explored what it's like to be a really good person and a really bad person. And so much of the game was about, narratively, about trying to do the right thing and be a good person. But yeah, the rest of them just kind of like Electro, who gives a shit. So yeah.
So one thing, and we were talking about this on text the other day, I mentioned to you is that the whole time where you're seeing the spider, all these cutscenes of the radioactive spider that escaped with MJ, I was really hoping that it was going to bite MJ, and mm-hmm. I was kind of disappointed when it bit Miles, because I want MJ to be a playable superhero badass in the next game, especially after playing a full game where she's just sneaking around and she gets killed every time she gets caught by a villain. Yeah. I want her to be able to like take that power and just be like really be partners with Spider-Man and just be kicking ass alongside him.
I get that, but at the same time, I do think that narratively that's less interesting because it's such a neat resolution when they finally figured out, okay, we're going to make this partnership work. I'm not going to worry as much about you and be overprotective. You know, you're going to help me out. And then suddenly she just becomes another Spider-Man and now, yeah. No, never mind. Doesn't matter. We're both superheroes. Like, that would be so neat that, like, so not neat, cool, but neat. Like, it would tie things up so neatly that having her instead, you know, just keep being a normal mortal is maybe more interesting for the story.
Yeah. So they need to, for the second game, if you can still play as her, they need to think of better gameplay mechanics for her than just sneaking around.
Yeah,
so
that
I have an idea. So part of the game, most of the game you're playing as Spider-Man, and maybe you switch off between Peter and Miles. Maybe Peter's injured or something and you have to play as Miles for a while. And then you switch to MJ, and MJ is in her office at the Daily Bugle, and you have to learn how to write in reverse pyramid style a news article starting with the lead, and then you have to go in order and you have to go find quotes, and then you have to transcribe your interviews and you have to pick out the best quotes and figure out how to put them in an article. Mm-hmm. And then you have to deliver your story to the editor, and then you have to accept your editor's edits without getting really mad at them, and then you have to incorporate them, and then you have to file by deadline, and then you have to do it all again the next day.
I can imagine the reviews for this liked, you know, and it's like same great web swinging as ever, really improved combat and stealth, surprisingly involved journalism simulation.
You would go, the tagline would be from web slinging to web writing.
Oh, God.
This is Spider-Man 2.
That would be, I'm sure that would sell millions and millions more copies than this one.
Oh, man. What if in Spider-Man 2, MJ has to deal with the fact that the Daily Bugle is being overcome by blogs, and she has to learn how to adapt to the internet?
Pivoting to video.
Oh, man. She has to start a podcast that competes with J. Jonah Jameson's podcast.
I was going to say, I actually really like what I liked about the J. Jonah Jameson podcast is that throughout the entire show, he was basically a kind of right-wing nut job conspiracy theorist. And there are plenty of those in the real world. But in this universe, it was this kind of fantasy anyways, because every person who calls in, with only a couple exceptions at very low points in the story, but almost always, he's like, Spider-Man is terrible and blah, blah, blah. And like, everyone's against you. And then people just always call in and say, well, no, actually, no, Spider-Man saved me. I mean, he's cool. Like, I don't know what you're talking about, man. And it would be, you know, it would be nice to imagine with the actual real world right-wing crazy podcasts if people would call in more often and be like, no, actually, you know, like, I have my health care because of Obamacare. You know, and it's really been kind of great for me.
That's the biggest fantasy of Spider-Man is radio callers who aren't crazy.
Exactly. It's like it kept coming to me. I'd be like, this really is like the most unbelievable thing about this game where I'm flying around the city is that the people calling into this right-wing like podcast are totally normal and setting the host straight.
Exactly. So we talked about the gameplay a lot. Obviously, the swinging is amazing. The New York City is just incredibly detailed and elaborate, even if it isn't 100% accurate. The combat is great, and I'm sure, as you saw, the combat just keeps getting more detailed.
I'm interested in the new game plus and sort of, you know, continuing to work with all the combos and options that I have. I didn't ever quite get to a place where I totally felt like I was in command of everything that was happening, because he's so vertical. Spider-Man is so like vertically capable, and it's possible to just be bouncing off everything and sort of jumping around. There was always a little bit of kind of goofiness to it, to the fights, that I never fully like got a handle on. But I think that was partly on me.
I felt the opposite way.
Oh, really?
Especially with using stealth a lot. So I would always use stealth. I'm sure too. And like I always learn the environment and then just use that to my advantage in some ways. And like for example, you can when you're shooting just regular webs at an enemy, if you just shoot them and they're just standing in the open, it'll just kind of stun them. But if you shoot them and they're near a wall, you shoot them a couple times and they'll stick to the wall. And like taking advantage of little stuff like that, or like using your abilities like the wall jump and like the swinging in midair, like holding abilities. Like I felt like by the end of it, I had a good command over everything, and I was just doing bases and enjoying getting all the bonus objectives and stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, like part of what I was saying, right, is that in New Game Plus, I think I would have even more command over everything. Mm-hmm. There's an aspect to how fast you're moving and how quickly you're jumping around the environment. A lot of times the camera isn't exactly pointing where it needs to be, so you're just hitting triangle and then jumping to the next guy, but you're not totally sure where that's going to be. There's a lack of... the game just can't quite keep up with how fast everything is moving in a way that it doesn't not work, because you're able to just hit triangle and then boom, you're fighting another guy.
Oh, that's interesting. So is that what you did? You just zipped around with triangle?
No, I mean, I got up in the air a lot. I juggled dudes as often as possible. Yeah. There's just enough stuff in the environment. A lot of times, like, say, okay, here's an example. I'm swinging around the city. There's a crime in progress. I'm way up in the air, and I just dive down, and I'm fighting a bunch of dudes. There's kind of cars everywhere, and I'm fighting, but, like, a lot of times, you know, you're just kind of, like, you bounce off the wall, and then you're kind of over here, and you're some guy is shooting at you, but you're not totally sure where he is, because, you know, there's a ton of people around, and it's sort of hard to see who's a cop, and the cops are shooting, and the cop bullets look the same as the other guy. There's a level of chaos to the fights that can be kind of hard to manage. I don't necessarily mean this as a criticism. It's more just that was sort of my experience of it. And then
that's so interesting.
The more I played, the more I kind of got my head around it and learned to read it. And, you know, then I got abilities also that let me disarm guys from a distance, and I got better at throwing and kind of combining things. There's just a lot to it. There's a lot of moves in it, and it requires a lot of sort of practice and also being in the right environment versus the wrong environment. And some of the environments are much better for fighting than other ones, I think.
Well, so the way that I navigated that chaos is by zipping out of combat a lot. So I would like use the L2 and R2 to go to perches in the middle of combat and like assess from above and then kind of dive back in. And it was almost kind of like aerial bomber style, where I would go out and then go back in and then go out and go back in, et cetera, et cetera. So
there's a way to do that.
I mean,
Spidey's a little hyperactive. Like when you run up a wall or when you stick to things, like he's pretty fast and jumpy, you know, which he should be. I mean, he's Spider-Man. Better than he's slow and like doesn't get out of things too quickly. But it's definitely a very fast moving, like kind of explosive type of combat that is, it's really fun, especially when it's working well and you're juggling guys and kind of doing the thing.
It just is. I just had so much fun with it just because of all the quips and the humor. And yeah, I just really enjoyed it a lot. Any final thoughts on Spider-Man or like what you want to see in Spider-Man 2 before we move to the off topic?
No, I'm glad they're going to make another one. I think that it's a great foundation, and that just because they got the most important thing so fucking right of just how fun it is to just swing around the city. I mean, with that kind of a fundamental established, the sky's the limit. I think they're gonna. Mm-hmm. I think the sequel to this game is gonna be phenomenal. I mean, it just would surprise the shit out of me if it wasn't. And I'm just looking forward to that. I think as much as they were like, this felt like a first entry, and there were some things missing and some kind of sloppiness outside of those really really solid main things. Clearly, the writers gave such a shit and just really wanted to, the actors gave such a shit. Everyone clearly really gave a shit about this game in a way that, you know, I appreciated. It came across in the finished product, I guess.
So, what's really cool about Spider-Man is that, like, it's not like the sequel is going to another city, because Spider-Man is so core, fundamentally New York. So they already have not only the fundamentals of swinging, but they already have this giant, detailed New York City environment that they can just expand and play more with.
They got to take us to Queens. We got to go to Queens, right?
Oh, yeah. 100% we're going to Queens in the next game, yeah. And probably all the other boroughs, too. Maybe we'll go to Westchester. Maybe we'll go to my hometown in the suburbs of Westchester.
Spider-Man 2, Westchester expansion.
Oh, my God. That'd be incredible.
It's like kind of just trees and houses. He doesn't have a whole lot to swing on.
It'd be amazing. Hey, if you could swing through Central Park, why can't you swing through
Westchester? That part always kind of threw me. I'm like, he shouldn't. It makes me think of the scene in Homecoming where he tries to swing in the suburbs and he can't. And I was always like, how am I swinging through Central Park? There are not that many antennas and telephone poles in Central Park.
I mean, it's sort of like how if you do that move where in combat where you swing up and then you shoot up and then you swing.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's an invisible bars above you.
Yeah.
So whatever. But yeah, I'm very excited. It's lots of really cool fundamentals for the next game. So I'm very excited. Yeah.
One last thought, actually, is a thing that I've noticed about this game is mainstream as fuck. There have just been a lot of people. Lin-Manuel Miranda last night, the guy who wrote Hamilton, is just like tweeting that he's started playing Spider-Man. A couple of like a political writer I follow is like, I'm going to go buy a PS4 to play this Spider-Man game.
It's huge.
I think it's easy to forget how mainstream Spider-Man the character is and how much people love him. And I think that people see this game because when you first see a clip of this game of just swinging through the city, you're like, holy shit, like that looks like a thing I want to play. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if this was something that brought a lot of people who haven't played a video game in a long time back to wanting to play video games, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, agreed. And it's just such a joy to play. It's just so delightful. You never feel like you're like, ugh. It never feels like a grind. It never feels like there's no killing, so that kind of helps in terms of feeling like there, you don't have to just shoot a bunch of people, and it doesn't feel like Arkham Knight in that you're not just driving a tank around and mowing over
and like
dudes
watching awful bioweapons attacks happen,
right,
stuff all the time.
Yeah,
even though I guess you do see that happen in Spider-Man, it just somehow doesn't feel it doesn't feel quite as dark.
No, when the dark stuff happens, you still have Spider-Man's kind of levity brighten your mood, and it's just a joy to play.
It's a great game.
Yeah, really good game. Really just kudos to Insomniac, and hopefully we'll have someone from Insomniac on the show in the near future to talk more about it.
That would be very cool. I'm sure our listeners would love that.
So let's talk about some off-topic stuff.
Yeah,
off-topic time. So real quick, last year, American Vandal season 1 came out, and I watched it after your recommendation. You told me I should watch it, and I watched it earlier this year. It was incredible, hilarious. It's this kind of serial satire that turns into something even bigger. It turns into a drama. And what's interesting about season 1 of American Vandal is that it starts off really funny, and then the humor kind of diminishes, and it becomes more of a serious drama in a really good way. Season 2 of American Vandal kind of embraces that. And it is way less about the humor. There's not a lot of humor in it, and way more about this great, fantastic, dramatic mystery story. Almost reminds me of Veronica Mars in the way that it just captures teen drama in this really good way, and this great mystery story. I loved season 2. I know you haven't started watching, or you started watching it and were overwhelmed by all the poop.
Yeah, I watched an episode and it was pretty gross, just because the prank in the first one was that somebody drew a bunch of dicks on the cars of the faculty members. And so there was a lot of dick jokes in the first season. The crime in the second season is that someone put laxative in lemonade at a school and all the kids shit their pants. And so then there's just all this sort of found footage style phone footage of people with like just shit all over themselves. And it was kind of a lot. But it definitely didn't make me stop or anything. I just have only watched one episode, and it's really cool to hear that it's good. I think we'll almost certainly watch the rest of the season.
I love season that's very much limited to the first episode. Like
that
there's still more
me.
Throwbacks to that, but it's all heavily in the first episode. And also, it's such a good season of TV, especially the last episode that ties it all together is just like, holy shit, it's incredible.
I felt that way about the first season, too. I like that in this one, they have they are now making a Netflix documentary because their first season that they made for their AV Club was so successful that in the second season, Netflix called them up and said, make. So there's this kind of meta layer to it that I thought was really funny.
And that's how they got that money to make all these recreations in this.
Right. This, and so now there are these, these 3D high tech recreations of whatever.
So I highly recommend that to anyone who's out there. Do you have any other off topic stuff to share other than your music pick of the week?
No, I'll just do my music pick this week.
Cool.
So my music pick this week is a sort of jazzy pick, a somewhat jazzy pick. This is a tune by the tenor saxophonist Stan Getz from the album Focus, and it's called Night Rider. And I guess I'll play a clip of it first and then talk about it a little bit. So here is how it begins. It's very dramatic. Here's the dramatic beginning of this song. So Night Rider is from this album Focus. It is a very different album for Stan Getz. He's one of my favorite saxophonists. As a saxophone student, he and Sonny Rollins are kind of the two guys that I transcribed a ton of and learned to sound like. People probably know Stan Getz best from The Girl from Ipanema. He did an album with João Gilberto that's all Antonio Carlos Jobim bossa nova tunes that are very famous. I mean, everyone's heard them, and he kind of has this famous sound. This album, though, is with an orchestra, so it's just him and then a string section. There's a jazz drummer on a couple of tracks, but it's mostly just sort of these original string compositions with him soloing over it. There aren't really any other albums that sound like this. It's a famous album among jazz, aficionados, but it's not very common. And this guy, Eddie Sauter, he was the composer and arranger, and he wrote all the music. So it's a super cool album, partly because it's this weird unicorn, kind of, in jazz. And the style of music, it was sort of called third stream. It was kind of like a genre that people tried to make happen and then never really happened. And the idea was, we're going to take classical and jazz and we're going to combine them. And if you think about this, this was recorded in 1961. So this is kind of right after the 50s, after the hard bop thing, and Miles and Coltrane were doing their thing. And everyone was kind of getting experimental with jazz and new harmonies in jazz. And there's this, it makes me think now, or at least of like in the 90s, where it was like rap and rock, and we're going to combine these two kinds of music. And there's even a kind of a like white music and black music, and we're going to put them together, and we're going to see what happens. And, it's sort of funny that they tried this and it failed, just sort of like rap rock was also kind of a failure, because it's like it feels manufactured, like you're trying to force two things to, there's plenty of, classical influence in jazz, and there's plenty of jazz influence in 20th century orchestral music. But at the same time, it did give us this album, which is this kind of fascinating, amazing album. So it's a really cool one, and it's called Focus. I recommend people check it out anyway.
Very cool. Fun story. When I was in Portugal, I was in Lisbon, Portugal, at the end of my trip last week, and they are big on this. Well, they're actually big on tourists, and tourism is like, someone told me that it makes up 80% of Lisbon's economy. But one of the things that they appeal to like tell tourists about is called Fado, and it's Portuguese blues music. And then I passed a restaurant, and there was a sign on it that said, "We don't play Fado, we play jazz." And so I took a picture and I texted you and I said, "Hey, look, it's all about what you don't play."
This same joke. I think one day on the show we should workshop a new jazz joke, because I bet we could come up with a few other ones for you.
Okay.
So then you could
have two options. That you call everything nasty and like really gross and disgusting really gross. And everything. It's all the most negative words for like really good stuff in jazz.
Oh yeah, he's sick. It's disgusting. It's revolting. Yeah, actually, and it's funny because that Stan Getz record I would never really call nasty or gross. It's just really
no.
Good
it's playing, not good enough but, to be called gross.
It doesn't kind of have that stankiness to it. It's still pretty clean.
Stanky jazz on the subway. That when I got in the subway, oh man, it smelled like jazz.
Yeah, maybe I'll pick some stanky jazz for next time. We'll see.
On that note, Kirk, I will see you next week.
All right, see you next week, Jason.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Kirk Hamilton and me, Jason Schreier. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're a part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mufidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope you leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at Kotaku.com/splitscreen or email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.